Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Hi, everybody. Congress is back in session and ready for a fight. Cabinet members head to the Hill to be back in the hot seat. And it turns out the deweaponization fund that the Justice Department recently announced with the Trump family may not be the biggest story of them all when it comes to the major settlement that we've been covering over the last several weeks. I'll explain all of that. We're going to unpack all of that. I'm glad to see you today. Thank you for joining us at Smarter News. We're about quick, concise, nonpartisan news, but occasionally we need to chat a little bit further, a little bit more in depth, and that's what we're going to do today because there is one word that comes up when I think about this week and what's happening with the news on multiple fronts. And that one word is escalation. We're seeing escalation of several stories abroad and here at home. And whether or not that escalation leads to more conflict is a question. In fact, there are some that believe you need that pressure to actually make movement on negotiation and compromise. That's one way to look at it. Of course, the risk is always that more escalation leads to more escalation, which leads to more conflict. But let's keep both of these things in our hands together as we look at some of the news stories in front of us, because they can go multiple directions, even if I say, you know, escalation is actually the word that we're thinking most about. So first, let me just start overseas just real quickly here, because it's a story that I saw reading in the New York Times, an actual physical newspaper. I know that's shocking. I walked all over Newark Airport yesterday looking for one. I find an airplane is a great place to actually read a newspaper, like an old-fashioned newspaper, you know? Remember back in the day when we had those things? Anyhow, still love a newspaper, still want to support all those that continue to print. So I walked over and found, a print of the New York Times, and hidden in the New York Times several pages back was this particular story. And I thought, this is something that I want to make sure, something I missed last week, and I want to make sure that you don't miss it as well. So let's talk about escalation when it comes to what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. We saw a drone strike that happened in Romania. Romania is bordering Ukraine. Romania is also a member of the European Union. It's also a member of NATO. That's going to be really important in a moment. As you know, there's constant fighting between Russia and Ukraine, and we do see at times threats extend over the borders. So we're seeing Ukraine become more aggressive, moving farther into Russia with some of their attacks. And then occasionally you see Russian drone strikes or strikes that are hitting in areas that are not Ukraine. And sometimes these reports suggest that these are wayward drones. You know, it's an accident. It wasn't on purpose. In Romania, Romania's leadership thinks this actually was on purpose. And there are some that believe that because the thinking is, again, looking at some of the foreign policy analysts that's coming forward based on this event and what's happening in Ukraine, is that Russia could be trying to push a little bit here, knowing a few things. We have a dearth of weapons and supplies and anti-drone systems, because we got a lot of conflicts happening all over in the world. So there's tensions being split from Eastern Europe with the Middle East, and weapons are being, the volume of weapons is being worked down. We've talked about this over the last several years, that because of the conflict in Ukraine, it is going to take time to replenish the stockpiles of weapons. So there's movement of attention away from this. There's a question about, well, what sort of supplies is out there to support our NATO member countries? What does that actually look like? And could Russia be trying to take advantage of this to try to put pressure on the European Union, to put pressure on Ukraine to move forward in negotiations? What makes this unique is the strike in Romania. The Romanian president says is the worst that he's seen since the war began. So that's number one of significance. And the second is, because Romania is a NATO nation, what we're going to look for here is trends. So two people were injured in this attack. It hit a civilian area. Russia, we don't know. Was this intentional? Was this not intentional? Was this an accident? We don't really know. And quite frankly, even if we have a bunch of people on the statement, we really don't know the intention behind this attack. But NATO, the largest military alliance in the world that we're a part of, that Romania is also a part of, has a principle of collective defense, which means if one of us is attacked, all of us are attacked, and therefore we will come to the defense of each other. If we see more attacks into a country like Romania, the question that emerges is, what will support of Romania look like? What position is the United States to help Romania? What about the rest of Europe? What about these other NATO nations? do we see the war extend now beyond the borders? Because now other people have to get more significantly and purposely involved. So I didn't want you not to have this on your radar. We have a lot of other things happening, but this is the latest coming out of this conflict and a question on the way forward and what's obviously next. That same question we can ask in the Middle East as well. We have a new announcement coming from Central Command about what we're describing as the United States as self-defense strikes. I want to put that in quotations because what is a self-defense strike? One could think a self-defense strike is you punch me, I'm going to punch you back. And the only reason I'm going to respond or attack you at all is because you attacked me first. But in which way does that work? You know, if there's one strike, do we only get one strike back if it's a self-defense strike? And if there's five strikes back, then does that mean that we're actually escalating as well? So be careful with that term. People are repeating self-defense strike over and over and over again. And I just want you to be aware of that's a unique phrase that we're using for this particular time period. The escalation in the Middle East is the following. According to U.S. Central Command, which is in charge of this area, this part of the world, Iran actually shot down one of our drones. We don't know if the drone was doing anything in particular other than surveillance, but Iran apparently shot it down. We responded. Now we also saw some incoming missiles into Kuwait, a neighboring Gulf state of Iran, one of the top 10 producers of oil in the nation. When things like this happen, this is when we start seeing oil prices jump around, because there's a concern about what's happening with the economy, about oil producers under threat. What does that mean for supply? So again, as we're looking towards the Middle East, we see escalation. This is interesting. At the same time of seeing this escalation, we have the president of the United States and others saying that they're getting close to a deal, that there's negotiations are being fruitful. In fact, President Trump put out on social media something to the effect that everybody needs to relax. Critics that are saying this is not moving fast enough don't really know what's happening behind the scenes, and it's all going to work out. That's what President Trump's message is on Monday. We'll see what it looks like 24 hours from now. But could both of these things be true at the same time? You see a little burst of escalation, and then we see movement in negotiations, or do we see a burst of escalation and a deconstruction of negotiations and more conflict? We don't know where this is going to stand at this moment. But this is what we're going to be watching moving ahead. So really important just to keep an eye on those two major conflicts that we're watching around the world. We could also use the word escalation when it comes to what's happening here at home, because we are seeing Congress return to Capitol Hill. And there is a new tone and tenor to this Congress because of a few different things. First of all, there's a big agenda in front of Congress right now. There's a lot of different potential legislation that could move. And there's a short window of time before the July 4th holiday, where there's going to be a celebration of America's 250th signing of the Declaration of Independence and really the birth of our nation. So we have a short period of time in June, and as summer heats up, you know, the tensions also heat up. Do you notice that sometimes the temperature outside gets hotter, people get a little hotter under the collar too? They want to do other things besides sitting inside an air-conditioned room negotiating on something that they don't want to do. They want to be back home on vacation, hanging out with friends, just like the rest of us. There's a little bit of an undercurrent to Congress during the summer when it comes to doing regular business, because there's a lot of, you know, again, people would like to be other places than in Washington, D.C. working. But this has a renewed focus, this particular time period, because of the midterm elections. So we're seeing these rolling primaries. We're seeing primaries this week in the United States, and primaries are really important because it's going to tell us who's going to wind up on the ballot and who's not. And in some cases, if you do not win your primary, I mean, in all cases, if you do not win your primary, you could still be serving in Congress for a couple more months, but you're not going to be back. And you might be a little angry about that. That adds a whole other dynamic, along with other lawmakers that are in the ballot, that now are thinking about, well, what do I do to actually make my constituency happy? How do I actually represent them most so I have something to go back to them and say, this is what I'm doing as I move forward to get your vote in November? So suddenly a Congress that could be coalescing around one leader, like the President of the United States, is now having these individual thoughts of, well, how is that going to serve me come election time? We have several high-profile senators, Senator Cornyn, Senator Cassidy, who lost their primaries. They are not going to be back in the Senate. both served for a long time. Both of them are not going to be back. That's mainly credited with a lack of support from President Trump. Although I caution you, there's a lot of dynamics at play with elections. That could be one of them. But that certainly doesn't win President Trump any favors to move his agenda forward from these lawmakers who he needs their support when he didn't support them in their election. So that'll be interesting to watch in the Senate, where Republicans have a very slim majority. And then in the Congress, the same thing. You know, Congressman Massey, for example, did not win his primary. He's not going to be back. And he doesn't have to do anything that the members of his own party are suggesting he does. He's a free agent right now. He's not trying to earn anybody's favor except do a good job, in his mind, for his constituents. Or maybe that's not even his calculation at all. But the bottom line is this is where the lame duck session begins. You have people on Capitol Hill, they're not going to be back. They can decide what they're going to do. They're writing their own destiny now. And that can create a dynamic that makes it much, much more difficult to pass any legislation. And the reason for that is because Republicans have such a tiny majority in the House of Representatives and such a small majority in the Senate that they don't have any room to lose people. So if they lose a few people, then everything gets stuck. And that's what we're watching for here. Can anything move in this Congress? We don't know. In the meantime, you do have members of President Trump's cabinet just by chance coming to Capitol Hill for sort of their regular hearings that they're supposed to appear in front of Congress. They need to give a report and accountability to Congress. Congress controls the purse strings of government. So any sort of money that's allocated is allocated through Congress. So that's why our cabinet members go to Congress and talk to our representatives. And this just happens at a regular cadence. So guess who's going to be on Capitol Hill this week? Secretary of State Marco Rubio is going to be there a couple of times. Secretary Bessin, the Secretary of the Treasury. We have the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Mark Wayne Mullen, back on Capitol Hill. He's going to be returning now, really, in the first time in his role. And we have some renewed controversy about immigration policies. There's a real flashpoint at a particular immigration center in New Jersey. You might have seen some of that on your social media that is showing a conflict between lawmakers for the state, but also protesters who are saying conditions inside this facility are bad. The government says this is the worst of the worst offenders at this facility, but the government's being called liars by their critics. There's protests. It's very kinetic. We're seeing police show up, law enforcement show up in riot gear. There were some arrests, according to the New York Post last night. It said at least 20 people are arrested. So that's a spot to watch this week. But Secretary Mullen's going to be on Capitol Hill. And then you have the acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, on Capitol Hill. So the gang's all here. There might even be more than that. Those were some of the top ones that we're going to see. So when we get those cabinet members in front of lawmakers, what happens? We have these fiery exchanges. Sometimes we have some moments of revelation. So we're going to be really watching these hearings. And if you see footage on your social media and otherwise throughout the week, this is why you're seeing that. It's because they're actually going to be on Capitol Hill and they're going to be answering some questions or not, depending on how they feel about those questions. We're going to finish this week, by the way, with the jobs report, which is going to be always a sobering piece of data that says, you know, despite all this noise of what's happening in the nation, here's what the job market looks like. So it'll be an interesting week to watch because we can anticipate news coming from Capitol Hill. And we know that there is a new dynamic. So what does that dynamic look like? We will see this week. Let's talk about a key part in the Senate and what's going on with legislation regarding immigration funding. To do so, let's take a big step back. What's happening in the Senate this week regarding immigration funding as one of the top topics for the Senate to try to tackle? This goes all the way back to these partial government shutdowns and a lack of funding, because we still have that conflict between Democratic lawmakers who say they don't like the policy of the federal government right now and Republican lawmakers that are trying to pass some specific funding to keep all of our agencies and branches funded. But there's a conflict over this. Rolling a grenade into the middle of this conflict is something new by this administration. Now, they may not have realized that that's going to be a factor in this legislation. Pardon me. Got a little choked up there, not because of the topic, just because I'm talking too fast. So I'll slow down a little bit. So what's happening in the Senate is actually directly tied to a settlement that is unprecedented in so many ways between President Trump his family, and the Justice Department. In order to understand the significance of this story, we actually have to deconstruct it. And we're going to deconstruct it in a way that I really want to lean into curiosity over commentary. Whenever we talk about President Trump and the Trump family and what's going on with the legal system, there's obviously a lot of emotions and political passions. That's normal. But as I was looking at this story, I realized, wait a minute, this story has been hijacked a little bit. And what's happening behind the scenes here is actually really fascinating and something that we've never seen before. So can we approach it in a way of, I've never seen this before. What do we think about it? And that's where I want to start with this story. So in order to understand what's happening with a de-weaponization fund and a settlement and how that affects immigration funding, we have to just go really big picture. So let's start off with some of the basics, okay? President Trump is the first president to ever be impeached twice. He was not removed from office, as you know, but he's the first president to go through that process twice. He's also the first president to be prosecuted, criminally indicted, and also found guilty of multiple felonies. He's the first president in history to ever have that happen. That happened during the campaign period, as you know, and there was a question about how does the law handle a former president and potential next president of the United States. We never saw anything like that before. He's also the first president to sue his own government, specifically under the executive branch. And to understand that, we have to just do some basic civics. And I had to do it too, because when we talk about these departments, sometimes we think about them as all separate entities. But the Justice Department and the Treasury fall underneath the executive branch. So when people say, well, that is President Trump's Justice Department, and President Trump's Treasury, they're saying it for that reason. They're also taking a political jab, saying that he's co-opted the policies of those departments. But that's how it's structured. That's how it's structured in any environment. You have President Biden, the Justice Department's under his executive branch. That's really important to understand, because when President Trump and his family sued the IRS, he was suing an entity within his own department that he oversees. And that's something that we've never seen before as well. So we're really in uncharted territory in this story. And it's a story that did get a lot of attention back in January. And as we talked about, there was a lot of things happening in the news at that time. We had gone into a foreign country and removed the leader, Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. We had a ton of immigration and customs enforcement protests were happening across the country. So that was going on. There's a lot of other news. And in all of this news, President Trump, his family, his two sons, and the Trump Organization, which is their business entity, sued the government, the IRS specifically, for $10 billion. At the heart of this lawsuit was an actual real case that also transpired, that maybe also didn't get the same amount of attention. So I just want to put this on your radar. There was a former IRS contractor who disclosed tax information of President Trump, his family, and who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for leaking this information. So that actually did happen. 5 years in prison, leaked this information to the New York Times and ProPublica, another organization, and it was confidential tax information. So that actually happened. This person was tried, he was convicted, he's serving time. So that is true. What happened with the group, President Trump and his family, is they said, we've been injured by this and we're gonna sue. And you know what? The cost of this damage to us was $10 billion. Huge number. So that, you know, when you file a lawsuit, like, doesn't mean you're going to get a result anytime soon. Doesn't mean you're going to be in court anytime soon. And so that happened with the splash, and then it kind of went away until a few weeks ago when we got a sudden announcement of a settlement. What makes this significant is not just the speed in which a settlement is reached, because if you look across the landscape of legal conflict, you know, reaching a settlement in a couple months on such a big topic is pretty unprecedented. I mean, think about this. Divorces can last several years. So this is bigger than that. It's involving more people, a lot of money. No offense to everyone going through a divorce or anything like that, but this is a really big deal. And there was a Senate announcement of a settlement. And the settlement was fascinating because it did map out a few things and didn't map out others. And then there were pages sort of attached to the settlement. So you had a major settlement announcement that had some details, and then you had a few other single pages that were released, and the language was not all the same, which is why at Smarter News, I focused on the settlement paper itself, not these addendums, because we couldn't really figure out where all this was coming from. And because it was new, what seemed like the most important focus was the deweaponization fund. The deweaponization fund is part of this settlement. We have very few specifics about it. What it says is that there's a huge fund of money. Okay, we're going to forget the $10 billion. We're going to take just under $1.8 billion. We're going to put it in a fund. And then anyone who feels that the government's been weaponized against them can appeal to this fund for money for compensation. We don't know the timing of that. We don't know who's going to oversee this group that would monitor these claims. We don't know if there's limitations to the claims. We don't really know anything about this. So this is where the focus was on for natural reasons of like, wait a minute, this is where, how does this even work? And who actually gets this money? But there was another side to this settlement that also got attention. But until we could sort of parse through the language, we didn't really know what to make of it. The settlement does a few things for those that are the plaintiffs, which is the Trump family and trust and affiliated companies. And what it says is that the U.S. has agreed to forever release and discharge them from all government claims. It precludes the government from pursuing future actions such as tax examinations or similar or related reviews, and any affiliated companies before that settlement date. So basically, anything that the Trump family did before May 19th is off limits for the government to look into tax-wise. Can't do it. Now, anything May 19th, May 21st, you do something tax evasion, you can be prosecuted for it. But before that, no. It's off the table. This is part of the settlement. The order covers any matters that were raised or could have been raised in the lawsuit and any matters currently pending or that could be pending. So it's like anything that's happened, you can't do it. This raised a lot of outrage by critics of President Trump, who said, how is that possible that you are absolved, including your family, including any of your business entities for any, you know, any sort of reflection or review of your business activities up until May, 19th, 2026. The one pause in context I think is important here is in settlements, that tends to be the case. The breadth of this is very big. Don't get me wrong, these are very high profile people. But let's say you're having a dispute, a legal dispute with your neighbor, and you can't find a way through, you have a legal settlement. That legal settlement will usually, it's not unusual for it to include, hey, by the way, you can never sue each other again. All right, like you guys got to agree to disagree. You can never sue each other again. This is the terms of the settlement. So it's not without precedent that settlements include that. And it will include up to that date. And then, you know, anything in the future is something else entirely. But because it's President Trump and these are people within his Justice Department that he's doing the settlement with, it's like negotiating with members of your own family, it definitely raised some eyebrows of, well, wait a minute, why is this happening? Now, to play devil's advocate, and maybe that's not the right term, to actually consider the other side, President Trump and his family feel like they have been targeted by a weaponized Justice Department, and they don't want to be targeted anymore. And this is one way that that's not going to happen, at least for now. It doesn't mean they can't get in trouble in the future. They can't be looked at in the future. But President Trump is not going to be in office forever. There will be Democrats that come to power. And will they weaponize, I'm saying in quote, the Justice Department against members of the Trump family? Because they're out for blood too. Now, there's critiques and accusations on all sides that President Trump is weaponizing his Justice Department. And he's doing that, he says, in response to a weaponized Justice Department. And we're going to ring around the rosy on that. But that's the situation right now. So we also have to consider that too, to be fair and report out this story. So here's the switch to this, though. Here's where the story changed last week that's so critical, because all of what I'm about to report to you was rumor, conjecture, and essentially gossip. It's very tough as a journalist to talk about reports that are not actually grounded in an actual quote. I know that sounds revolutionary, but it's true. So as this settlement surfaced in the news, there were critics of President Trump that said, this is fraud. This is actually fraud being committed against the American people. This whole case, this $10 billion lawsuit, was filed for this reason, to absolve them of any wrongdoings that they could have done in the last several decades. This is the whole point. The lawsuit's not actually about this IRS contractor, although there actually is an IRS contractor. This is about something else entirely. And now we actually have court filings that suggest that. So here's what happened last week. So this was Wednesday of last week. 35 former federal judges appointed by both Democrats and Republican presidents filed a motion to reopen the underlying lawsuit, arguing that the lawsuit itself, this is the $10 billion lawsuit, and we're suing you guys because of what happened with this IRS contractor. So they're arguing the lawsuit itself was fraudulent. The settlement was a, quote, product of collusion and is itself a fraud on the court. So these former judges are appealing to the court separately to say, something's wrong here. This is not normal. We need to take another look at this. And then on Friday, a Florida district judge, after initially closing the case because there was a settlement, that was it, actually said, wait a minute, we're going to reopen an inquiry. So there was an ordered opening of an inquiry. This doesn't mean that the case is going to be reopened. It doesn't mean anything. It just means the judge is like, all right, let's take another look at this. And the inquiry is into, quote, whether the court was deceived, included with respect to the existence of an underlying case or controversy and any purported arm's length negotiations undertaken to resolve it. Now, President Trump and his team have a few weeks to respond. They have to respond by next week, laying out a response to these allegations of collusion or deception and whether or not the court case should be reopened. If this court case, if the original case is reopened, it basically, we don't even really know. What does that mean for the settlement? Does the settlement go away? We actually don't know. It would be very, very significant. There's a high bar to reopen a case that has been closed. So that's number one. But number two, now we have multiple judges, including those that appeal to the court, saying, I'm just going to raise a red flag here. Something else is happening. And this could actually be the big story. The de-weaponization fund is a big story, but we just don't know what's going to happen with that. And quite frankly, if this goes forward, we don't even know if it's going to be operable at all. So this is the story. Now there's accusations that this whole thing is complete fraud of not only the American court system, but of the American people. And what could have been a settlement that, you know, maybe wasn't going to be challenged until it was in action. Because in order to challenge something, you have to say you've been hurt by it. So maybe if somebody appealed to the de-weaponization fund and they didn't get a claim, then they could say that they were hurt by, who knows? We were actually trying to feel like, think about creative ways that this could be challenged because it's a settlement. Like a settlement is a settlement. It's hard to challenge a settlement because the two sides are coming together. But this is how the former federal judges found a way. And that's what they did. They appealed to the court. And so that's how this is starting. So I don't know where the story goes from here, but what was sort of a, I don't want to say a sleepy story back in January, now could become a very big story and not what the president and the Justice Department intended, because it could be back in the court systems to be litigated in some capacity. Again, very rare to see that, but I just listed off all the unprecedented ways that the president has interacted in some capacity with the legal maneuvers of Congress or the courts outside of that. We've never seen that before. We've also never seen this before. So we need to have some humility about how this is going to move forward. I know there's a lot of, you know, strong feelings about all of this, but we've never really seen this before. And we'll have to see where this winds up. Speaking of the anti-weaponization fund, separately, a Virginia district judge temporarily blocked the administration from setting up the fund. That order is in effect for the next couple of weeks. So let's go back to Congress really quick. What Congress is saying, what Republican leadership is saying is, hey, President, guess what? When you throw in this you know, de-weaponization fund that has no parameters, now we have Democrats that are calling for parameters. We don't really have a good argument to not set up parameters because no one knows what this is going to be like. So now we're in a situation where we may have to set up guardrails to you, who is the person that we're trying to fall in step with as Republican leadership. And now everybody's kind of crossing ways with each other. And that holds up legislation. At the end of the day, all of this does is it distracts and it holds up legislation. So when you ask, why isn't Congress doing anything? Here's one of the reasons why, because they can't figure out a way through when it comes to immigration funding. Part of it is now Democrats are saying, yeah, not only do we not agree with the immigration policies, we also don't like this de-weaponization fund. So if you want to work with us and put guardrails on that fund, maybe we work with you with immigration, but we're not sure. And who has the better standing for voters ahead of the November elections? So this is how all of these different threads get into a tangled web. And here's where we sit on Monday, June 1st with a big question about where all these stories go. But it's certainly not calming down. So that's why the word escalation applies also to this particular legal case. So we're going to watch that. So this is a lot of... There's a lot here. We have a great question on our live chat I want to address. Is this similar to presidential pardons for family members done during the last administration? So let me talk about that just for a second, because it's something that easily could come up. Why is that? President Biden pardoned his son, Hunter Biden, in a sweeping way. His son was facing prison time for one legal case that he had been prosecuted. And the president made the case that this was unusual and his son was under threat, and he ended up pardoning his son in the last final hours of his administration. He pardoned his son going up until that date. So anything that his son did up until that point, he pardoned. He's not going to prison for it. He's not going to be prosecuted for it anymore. It's wipe your hand of it. But it did not apply to anything that happened moving forward. The president can't, I mean, I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't think there's any sort of proactive pardon that could take place. But there is that risk that if Hunter Biden does something, quote unquote, bad again and breaks the law, then he could certainly face prosecution. But he got a big clean slate through that pardon. These are a little bit different, though. They're similar in the breadth of the protection that is afforded a member of the president's family. This protection against, tax prosecution for the Trump family is extending to the president's sons. And the pardon extended to Hunter Biden, the president's son. So you could see that. But they're also very different processes. The power of pardon is very specific to the president. Any president has the power to pardon. Often these pardons can be controversial. But it is a power that lies with the presidency. And it's up to his prerogative about how he wants to use it. In President Trump's case here, he is negotiating with members of his own Justice Department. So it brings up an unusual dynamic. And that's why it's also raising questions of trying to use the system to benefit the family in a way that's not the way the system should be used, which is what these judges are filing this motion to take a closer look at. So just a good reminder here, though, we need things on the record. There was all this sort of accusations flying about the president, de-weaponization fund, settlement. Until someone's on the record and we can point to it, it still stays in that realm that makes it difficult to report, because a feeling is harder for me to report than something that's a fact that's on paper. It just is. I know we've heard those sort of phrases before, but it matters. And a lot of what we're seeing across social media is conjecture, a lot of folks talking about how they feel about a topic. And those feelings are important. We're a free country. Their feelings can affect our feelings. And that's where the power of editorial is. And that's the freedom of the press, freedom of speech. We want those things. But also keep in mind, there's also actual journalism and reporting. And sometimes we have to hold back because we're looking into an issue and trying to figure it out. The power of curiosity over commentary really came to center stage in a few ways in my life over the last week. We had a really significant conversation with the governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Shapiro. That's going to be part of our broadcast and news coverage over the next several weeks. And I too found myself pulled, questioning myself, like, oh, is this electric enough of a conversation? Is this going to get us, what are we going to learn from this? I kept going back to, what are we most curious about in this nation? What do we actually want to talk about? When I think about what our audience at Smarter News actually feels compelled to talk about, it's really broader, big issues about honesty and leadership and the Constitution. What does America stand for? These are very big questions that don't get a lot of time. And that's where curiosity, when you turn things around and don't lead with commentary, how you feel about it, but a question of, hey, why do you believe that? What is that about? How did that make you feel? These are basic questions that don't feel special or important, but in our news environment right now, they are, because everybody's so quick to lead with what they think rather than what actually is on the record. And at Smarter News, we're always going to fall back to what's on the record, and we're always going to embrace asking questions, curiosity over commentary. It's a good phrase. I'm glad we came up with it. And it applies to all aspects of your life. So you can try it this week when your kid does something weird, or a spouse, or a boss, or someone disappoints you. Maybe it's an employee. And instead of being like, what in the world? You say, tell me about, why did you do that? Like, how was your day? What else is happening beyond X, Y, or Z? It'll always endear you to those folks, because you may get some information that you didn't know that explains some of the behavior that you may be questioning, but you save yourself because you could just launch into a monologue that doesn't win you any fans. And ultimately, you know, working together does elicit the best results. I know it's difficult with children. It's difficult in a lot of capacities, but in children too. I do find it interesting, like, why did you take mommy's box or makeup like my son did the other day and use it as a painting palette? Like, why did you do that? Oh, you couldn't reach your paints? Okay. You know, like, those are, you know, doesn't excuse the behavior, but also all in a day's work, guys. All right. Thank you for your support of quick, concise, nonpartisan news. I see a couple other questions in the chat. Let's keep it going on social media or otherwise. You can also join and become an insider and join our live broadcast, which we love. We have a great community here. We chat before the shows. And also, we can continue those conversations in the comment section online. I always check in and want to make sure that whatever questions you have, we can help you, because we're here to actually do that. We want to help you navigate this new space to free up your time so you can live your life and choose whatever you want in your chapter and not be so focused on other people's stories. So thank you for your support of Smarter News, quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. And we'll be back throughout the week with updates on these stories, what's happening on Congress, on Capitol Hill, and throughout the rest of the world as we continue to watch a lot of dynamics at play. So an interesting week ahead. Thanks for being here. And I hope you have a great one wherever you are. Bye, guys.